was Reflections of God by Jaubi off of their new release, A Sound Heart. Before that, cover of Bruce Springsteen's I'm on Fire by Electrolane. It's great stuff. And if you're interested in music that you've been listening to, check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org. Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh. Have a great night, folks. Take care of yourselves.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Richard Gordon and she's...
Riona Duncan.
And we're here with two fine professors of our acquaintance to talk about some translation issues.
We have Christopher Jones, who's Professor Emeritus of French and Francophone Studies at Carnegie Mellon. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
So glad to have you here. And we also have Marcy Forsine, who's Assistant Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in Classics down at Pitt.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much.
I just got to start by saying I knew that Christopher had been all over the place and learning all sorts of different languages, but I was amazed when I just learned that he got to Portugal to play pro basketball, and he had one word in Portuguese.
That's correct. And it was an eye-opener of going to Portugal after having been a very poor student of German, and I still have no German, but being dropped into a bath... Mm-hmm. of a foreign language and at a time when there were very few English speakers mm-hmm. in Portugal. So it was sink or swim, so to speak, and I swam. Mm-hmm.
As hard as it is for us to understand each other when we speak the same language, what the heck happens once you start adding different languages?
Increased difficulty, I think, but also increased opportunity for communication to happen, right? So there's some places where languages can meet the needs that another language doesn't realize it has. So, for example, you might think of how in Japanese there's a particular word for someone who is an upperclassman who might be a mentor figure for you, a senpai. We don't have an equivalent like that in English, which can make things kind of difficult, like when you're trying to refer to someone who is a third-year graduate student and you're a mere first-year graduate student and utterly lost in the sauce. It can be nice to be able to refer to someone who has advanced experience than you, but English doesn't have any such word.
Wait, you're a classics professor and you're telling us about words in modern Japanese?
Well, that's not... I don't know very much Japanese. Maybe someday, though.
It is true that many languages have these levels. In Japanese, it's honorifics, but in Chinese and in Latin languages, there's familiar and formal ways of address, mm-hmm. which for Americans can be somewhat problematic. But we do eventually adapt if we're planning to integrate ourselves into the culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it can lead to interesting problems and opportunities, even in classics. So I remember going to a lecture some years ago by Professor Jinyu Liu, who was in the middle of translating some of Ovid's love letters into Japanese. And in Latin, it is very rare to use personal pronouns because it's an inflected language. So the verbs contain the concept of who is doing an action. So you don't need to use tu very often or vos very often. It's implied in the verb. But the very first word, when you translate into Japanese, a love poem that begins with "you are so beautiful" needs to be one of these levels of familiarity. Is it anata? Is it anta? Or is it something more formal than that? And I remember just being blown away by her lecture on this.
Going back to Americans learning other languages, do you think Americans are worse than other cultures at learning language? Because I've heard that from various people.
You often hear it from Americans themselves, right? Oh, I'm bad at languages and so forth, not naming any names. I think learning languages is, there is an aptitude. I don't think there's any research that shows that any particular cultural group is better or worse than another at learning languages. But then you get around to need. If you need to learn a language, myself arriving in Portugal and being interviewed by a journalist, needing someone to interpret, then going into a small town where there was an American pastor who spoke English, and that was it. The need, and I got it by then also. But how many Americans in their kind of daily life need to learn another language? Some, you know, if you're working in the medical fields, even sometimes in law and places like that, where at least you might need a decent knowledge of Spanish. In the courts, you somehow need to be able to communicate in English what a witness may have only been able to express in Ukrainian or something like that. I mean, that's, so there is need there, but it's not a broad, a large need among Americans generally. And without getting into the fact that the world speaks English now, that makes us worse students of language.
One of the things that I think affects it is fear of failure. I didn't take French or Italian or Spanish or German. I stuck with Latin, which was taught to me as a dead language. Sorry.
Yeah, but, no, I understand.
A fear of failure. I didn't want mm-hmm. to do this. And mm-hmm. when my son and I took a trip to Germany, I got along with the shopkeepers better than he did, even though he was studying German, because he was too scared to make a mistake.
Right, absolutely. This is an anecdote, but when I was in college, I was fortunate enough to live with two of my best friends, who I'm still very good friends with. And one of them, her primary language was Spanish, and she spoke Spanish with her family. And my other friend's primary language was Taiwanese. And I remember moving in with them and saying, hey, wouldn't it be great if I could improve my Spanish with you and start to learn Cantonese with you? And then both of them, as one, basically turned to me and said, it would be too much work. We want to actually be your friend, not your teachers. Right? So there's this space for failure. There's, you know, the question of how you can immerse yourself. There's the urgency, the need to learn. And then there's also this ease of communication by having what's often referred to as a lingua franca, right? Which English serves as a lingua franca in the U.S. And so some people might accuse Americans of being lazy by defaulting to English, but actually a lot of times it allows us to cut through these difficulties of, oh, that's not the word that you mean. I'm not looking for that word. I'm not going to correct your grammar. We're going to have the conversation instead. But it is a lost opportunity as well. And at the end of 2 years of living with these two folks, my friend who was trying desperately not to teach me Cantonese finally capitulated enough to teach me how to say "wobu dojo we," which means I don't speak Mandarin.
Je m'appelle Richard, je ne comprends pas français, you know?
Je parle un peu de français. Mais c'est terrible.
Another difficulty, I think, in translation is when it gets beyond even just the literal, like, what word do you get to correct, and gets more into translating poetry. How have you guys experienced that?
Translation of works of art, whether it's poetry, fiction, and then, of course, there are other areas of translation like law, contract law, for example. I've had an experience with that. But poetry, song, fiction, we really have all these not just linguistic elements, but cultural elements. So word-to-word translations are often ridiculous, and really do not carry the meaning in any significant way. And a couple of examples that occurred to me, I don't know whether you've ever read Montalbano, the Inspector Montalbano, who is a Sicilian, written by a guy named Camilleri, who writes in this extremely idiosyncratic Sicilian dialect. Where do you start? I'm a translator. I speak perfectly adequate English. And it's Midwestern English, which is to say Tom Brokaw's English, i.e. the standard English, if there is such a thing in the U.S. And I'm going to translate this Sicilian writer who writes in a Sicilian dialect, which is strange even to Italians. Where do you start? First of all, there's all the aspects of the culture itself, everything from dress, interaction between the sexes, food, daily life, and all that other kind of stuff. But then you have to somehow get across to an English speaker this dialect, which is non-standard. Now, he has been translated into like a Jersey dialect, you know, some sort of really heavy New York area dialect, you know, with all this kind of weird expressions and so forth, which is a legitimate effort,
right,
to take that across. Mm-hmm. Now, poetry is a whole different story, and song, which is, of course, my principal area of expression these days. For example, I just did, which Richard has, a CD in French, working with a poet from Montreal. Mm-hmm. And I did translations of his texts. I wrote some myself in French. And we just gave a presentation up in Quebec City on this. And what it meant and what my translations were. And my translations were de sens, of the sense. Mm-hmm. It was not possible without another year to attempt to write his texts into an English song with the same music and so forth. And that's almost never done because of the level of difficulty,
right,
both cultural and the additional complication of music, and then, the demands of rhyme and colloquial expression and all those sorts of things really complicated.
I think terribly. I think I've seen the closest I've seen to that is, you know, besides your record Montreal Encore, is if you go to the opera and there are super titles, mm-hmm, in your language while they're singing in the original language,
right,
or if they're singing in whatever the language is of the audience as opposed to the original that was written in.
Right. And
yeah.
Thinking about your experience with music, Christopher, it reminded me of Louis Armstrong's translation of Yankee's, which is dissonance, right? It's not word for word. And when you try to translate music sensibly, you have the understructure of the music itself, right? So you get the jazz undertones. You know that it's a love song when you start listening to it, whether it's Louis singing it or Edith Piaf. And turning to Riona's question to think about poetry can be very difficult, as you highlighted, Christopher, but we do have, just like in music, the song that supports the melody, the instrumentation. In poetry, you have the meter, the rhyme scheme, the vocabulary decisions, and, you know, in classics, one of the places where this becomes fun and interesting and difficult and problematic is the age of the text that you're looking at, because so many people want or expect to open a translation of, say, the Aeneid or the Iliad and be met with something that sounds like Shakespeare to them, something that is archaic and grand and maybe bombastic. Virgil's Latin is fairly bombastic, but Homer's Greek is very readable, and it paces very quickly, and it has this beautiful flow to it, which is so difficult to put into English meter in a way that doesn't sound heavy or difficult. And we have all of these names to wrestle with, and all of these epithets and formulae that feel very alien to American poetic forms, right? So why is he always swift-footed Achilles or horse-tail-helmeted Hector, which all of those things just feel very burdensome to us, whereas we would just say Hector came on, and we would have other alliterations and descriptions.
Marcy, one of the things that Riona told me about you that I just am fascinated about is that one of your areas, especially, is that period of time when Latin and Greek coexisted at the top of the European pyramid.
Yes, yes. So my area of specialty is Roman satire, especially early Roman satire. So Riona and I got to talking in the course of this Latin class that we engaged in, which was an epic Latin class, but an epic Latin class not on the Aeneid, but on its predecessor, which is a fragmentary text called the Annales. And we were looking at this time period in Roman history, which is roughly the end of the 3rd century BCE into the 2nd century BCE, when Rome starts to become an empire, even as it remains governmentally a republic. But one of the first places that Rome colonizes is Greece, just across the Tyrrhenian. And what's so interesting about this is that in many ways, the Italian peninsula had already been Greek, right? So Naples, for example, was a Greek colony. And Ischia, as we know it now, was already a Greek colony. So Naples is Neapolis in Greek, or the new city. So even before Rome formally triumphs over Macedon and takes over the Greek mainland, the people who speak Latin are side by side, neighbors, poets in common, philosophers in common with people who speak Greek. And these languages are so closely related to one another, but to come back full circle, they're also not quite fully mutually intelligible. They use different scripts, they have different vocabulary. It's not different from, say, a Spanish speaker who goes to Portugal and can understand maybe 60 to 70% of what's going on, but is still missing nuances and still struggles to get the pronunciation right, etc. So it's a fun period of time because there's so much happening politically in the space, and there are all of these ways in which the Romans are trying to navigate this new prestige that they have over these neighbors that previously had dominated the Mediterranean. So they're grappling with this newfound power, whereas the Greeks are on the opposite side of things. They're trying to understand how they've lost these wars, who these neighbors are. Are they actually Greeks after all? They speak a very similar language to us. And this is something that Dionysius of Halicarnassus, for example, says, oh, it's okay that we were conquered by the Romans. The Romans are actually Greeks.
I don't think of Greek and Latin or Greek and Italian as similar.
Greek and Italian are pretty distant, especially modern Greek and modern Italian.
Okay.
So the linguistic journeys of those two languages through phonetic vowel shifts in particular have made them incredibly distinct languages in the contemporary world. But if you were to map out the Indo-European family tree, for example, you would put Greek and Latin as close branches on the same bough.
Would you say that, you know, the Latins are Greek because they speak a similar language, for example, if, you know, you got to make yourself feel better. Would you say that the different languages also lead to, like, maybe similar forms of thinking or forms of doing things culturally?
This is interesting. So this is an argument that I think Noam Chomsky iterates in one of his very, very many works. And it, you know, again, kind of comes back to what we were discussing earlier about how some languages seem to fill gaps that others don't necessarily know that they have. To me, it seems that we have sort of a Gordian knot of which comes first, right? Does language form the way that we think, or does the way that we think form language? And it's a very difficult and very slippery slope, because if we start to think of language determinism, then that can be utilized to argument for certain hierarchy of languages, which are false, I think. I think that every language offers something unique, and I think languages are born and utilized within social contexts that shift over time, right? So I think for the Greeks who are saying, hey, Latin is so similar to our language, it's basically like we were conquered by our cousins, so it's not a big deal. They're utilizing language politically, but they're also doing that purposefully rather than saying, oh, you know, because we speak the same language or we speak sibling languages or cousin languages, it's inevitable that we would be a part of this, the same empire, right? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Christopher, please chime in.
So, yeah, the notion that language determines what we're able to think is what really interests me. And I brought in this book called Language, Thought, and Reality by Benjamin Lee Whorf, who makes this thesis explicitly using the Hopi language and so forth. When I was reading this, I was living in Lisbon. I had near native fluency in Portuguese, a good start on French and Spanish. And I thought, okay, I sort of get this. Now, I'm not feeling that difference in a restriction in the way I would think in any of those languages. So let me try something else. The time I had a visit from someone who was very politically involved, I was choosing between Chinese and Japanese. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, you can't learn Japanese, those capitalists, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, I went and then studied Chinese at the University of Paris, where there were 1,000 first-year students of Chinese who were all there because they wanted to be Red Guards.
Mm, right.
They wanted to. They were Maoists.
The Cultural Revolution.
They were Maoists during the Cultural Revolution. This was back a ways. Well, it worked for me. One of his Whorf's primary theses is that languages divide space in time. I mean, these are basic concepts, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Latin-based languages have quite a sophisticated way of saying, well, yes, 2 years ago, but before then, and even before then, and then after that, before type of thing, which is, we take it for granted, you know. Even in English, even though we don't have the formal conjugations that the Latin-based languages do. But in Chinese, there are essentially three
adverbial time markers.
Yeah, exactly. You can say, okay, it's happening, it stopped happening, or it will happen. That's it. At one point, I tried to actually interpret in this school that I was in, the National Institute for Oriental Languages, they have an interpreting sort of program. And I did some kind of self-testing of interpreting between English and French. Mm-hmm. It was possible. I mean, it's extraordinarily stressful in terms of your cognitive machine. But when I tried to translate from Chinese to French, mm-hmm. I immediately got this massive migraine. It was just not. People do it in diplomatic circles. They're mostly Chinese. It's very rare to have American interpreters be able to make that leap and frame a Chinese expression of time, space, and all the other content that's going into the message. Make that back and forth. Anyway, this was, for me, this was a kind of a seminal moment. The notion that, you know, what I might think I was clever, but I could only be as clever as the languages I knew. I couldn't be Chinese clever, really. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be Hopi clever, and so forth. And anyway, this is, you know, what does it mean to use a certain language to think, much less write or translate, you know? So.
Do you sometimes find that there are some ideas you can only think of in one of the languages you know? They don't work in another language?
I think that's true, although the languages in which I'm really fluent, I mean, I finished a degree in Chinese, but that was, it's not fresh anymore. 可以说一点儿,但是我的中文不错了。So I
have
good accent.
We'll have to include subtitles.
No, I think to your point, one of your many points here, there are always things that are difficult to capture fully from one language to another. But I guess I have the follow-up question. When these difficulties occur in translations, I have to ask myself sometimes if I'm struggling with grammar and syntax, right? The framing of the language itself, which to your point about Mandarin and Cantonese with these time markers versus tenses, which inflected languages in European descent have different tenses and aspects structured built into the languages. Yeah. Or if it is, to Worf's point, a system of thought that is reflected as different. And to me, I love this title of the book. I'm looking at it right now, and it's Language, Thought, and Reality, because to me, language is one way in which we approach reality, right? And so we might have a language that doesn't allow us to express temporality beyond just now, and soon to come. But we still live in the same time-space continuum as people who have inflected languages that have, I used to be able to do this, I was starting to do this, I will in the future have done this, right? Which is something that is much more Latinate or Greek or Germanic. And to me, the fact that we live in a world where we're constantly, even in spaces that seem to be carved out as more monolingual, to me, we are still exposed to people who are speaking different languages and utilizing time in different ways. So I wonder, I don't like to think of this as restrictive. I like to think of these languages as being mutually buoying one another up, if that makes sense, right? The opportunities that you have to express time in Mandarin contrasted with the opportunities you have to express time in German compared to what you can do with Icelandic, right? They're each different and complementary. But maybe that also means that there are limiting factors. Maybe you don't get one without the other.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I mean, your basic point that this is not a limitation but rather an expansion, I totally accept that. In other words, what it brought me to study Chinese and to learn Latin languages and so forth was not a limitation. I mean, it broke me out of my mold.
Yes.
In a very important way. And in these ways, but in cultural ways and
yes,
sort of ways of being, seeing, interacting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And something that Rione's heard me talk about in class before is that often the best way that you learn your primary language is by learning a secondary language. You don't realize that you didn't have a word for something until you learn that word in another language.
Or in my case, I really, really had to learn my English grammar while I was teaching English as a second language to students whose TOEFL scores were too low to be admitted to the University of Missouri, and they had to pass my course.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. You have to think about why to use that versus which in certain scenarios, and why would you use quad in a certain place but not in another place? And why would you use the subjunctive here but not there? Sorry to get into the Latin jargon of it all.
I once had a Mexican student tell me, "Mr. Richard, your language is so impoverished without subjunctive."
Yes, they were absolutely right. But it's so interesting because this concept of language poverty actually goes back to the ancient world, because I promise that I won't always reset us to the year 100. But
please do, honestly.
But we have as early as Lucretius, who writes a poem, an epic poem about Epicurean philosophy and how everything is doomed to decay and destruction. That's a great poem. Very exciting read. He opens up by saying, I'm translating Greek philosophy into Latin, and it's so difficult because of the egestos of Latin. And the egestos means essentially the beggarliness, the absolute grasping need that this language has. And it's true that if I were to pull out a Latin dictionary versus a Greek dictionary, the ancient Greek dictionary would easily be at least three times the size of the Latin dictionary. It is by far and away a much shorter vocabulary. And so as far back as Lucretius, we have someone saying, oh, your language is terrible. But in his case, he says, my language is terrible. I need to use Greek, which is fascinating because then he doesn't. He uses Latin instead.
Our conversation with Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from CMU, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of Classics at the University of Pittsburgh, was so intriguing that Riona Duncan and I decided to split it in two. Tune in again for Forbes Avenue to hear part two of our discussion about translation and language.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we first hear from a professor of education on how the growing banning of books, censorship of teachers, and clampdown on student protest works to the benefit of those who would lead our nation into fascism.
We speak with Professor Henry Giroux, one of the great educators in North America, about his hopefulness in the student movement finding allies throughout the broader society.
We have another in our series of shows about fascism by talking to Diane Feeley, a labor historian and activist, about the consequences of unions in the U.S. continuing to place their workers' fate in the two major political parties.
She argues that doing so has not served their members well, has led to a growing fascistic divide in America, and that what is needed is a true workers' party.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Fascist Germany's industrial murder of Jews in Europe 80 years ago has been seared into the consciousness of humankind. Today, it's a great irony of history that the Israeli government, which claims to be the moral legatee of the Holocaust, is carrying out a genocide against millions of Palestinians in Gaza. This is being done with the full support of the American government, which supplies political, diplomatic, and propaganda cover for what Israel is doing. It supplies the bombs, planes, artillery shells, tanks, and bulldozers to physically destroy the buildings and infrastructure of the Gaza Strip. The people who live there have been systematically starved as the Nazis starved the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. The response of American students in college campuses across the country was magnificent. Tent encampments sprung up in several hundred places. They became the focal point for a full-throated discussion of the realities in Gaza and American complicity in the ongoing genocide. Demands for ceasefire were raised, demands that the universities divest themselves of investments in Israel and American arms manufacturers were put forward. Sadly, this manifestation of critical thinking came to a crashing end. The wealthy and their servants in Congress and in the mass media accused the students of being anti-Semitic and of supporting terrorism. Congressional hearings were held. University presidents were fired. Professors lost their jobs. Students were expelled from schools. The great campus uprising was closed down. To talk to us today about education, fascism, and democracy is Professor Henry Giroux. He currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department of McMaster College in Canada, and is the Pablo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Creative Pedagogy. Henry Giroux has authored many books, most recently with Anthony DiMaggio, titled Fascism on Trial, Education and the Possibility of Democracy. Professor Henry Giroux, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, Henry, with the suppression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement on campuses, is it fair to say that the campuses have been turned into the American Homeland Security campuses?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, I think in many ways what we're seeing, particularly in light of the protest against Israel and its slaughter of the Palestinian people, is we're seeing that the question of free speech is now being responded to, not by dialogue or an attempt to sort of understand the issues or to give students an opportunity to narrate themselves, but students are now met with snipers, checkpoints, violent police crackdowns. And in many ways, I mean, what we're seeing is militarized policing as a response to dissent. I mean, my argument is that what's happening on campuses in the United States, and in some cases, a number of other countries, is that the role of education as a democratic public sphere is being challenged in ways unlike we've ever seen before. I mean, all of a sudden we have billionaires who are basically supporting repressive policies, and we have the military basically being called in, the police, to suppress dissent. Students are being beaten, faculty are being arrested. I've never seen anything like this since the 1960s, and I think it's fair to say that, as Michael Gold-Watofsky has argued, that what we now have is the American Homeland Security campus, that the notion of repression is not just simply around censorship. It's basically about the beating of bodies and the arresting of protesters and the reliance upon the military, the reliance upon the police to turn the campus into a police precinct. So it's pretty hard not to assume that something radical has changed with respect to questions of academic freedom and dissent, particularly when the dissenters, the protesters, have really expanded the nature of their own critiques, and not just against the war in Gaza and of course increasingly in Lebanon. They're against the university in some ways, suppressing free speech and investing in the war machine. That's dangerous.
Henry, let's talk about public education overall in the country today, if we can. Public education, it seems to me, and you've just been talking about one aspect of it, but at a broader level, it's under attack in the form of banned books, erased history, if certain parts of our history are even reported on in the textbooks anymore, the form of banned books, erased history, as I say, and the suppression of dissent, as you've already pointed out. You've written that education is never really neutral anyway. It's always a political act. And you wrote that it either serves to, well, liberate or domesticate, to either empower or to subjugate. Talk to us about that.
I mean, I think it's very clear that education is always political. There's no such thing as neutral education. Power is never not related to education in the form of the way the curriculum is produced, the way the funds are allocated, the way the public and higher education function as sorting machines. But I think the real issue here is that education is central to political struggle because it's a means of fostering particular forms of agency, self-reflection. It basically functions in a way to legitimate certain conceptions of the self, their relationship to other, history, and how we view the future. And so I think in that way, when you talk about, for instance, banned books, censoring history, the suppression of labor, indiscriminate attacks on civic culture, all of these things suggest that education is a tinderbox, meaning that it either can function critically, educate students in a fundamental way to be informed and to be critical thinkers and engage citizens. I think that what's really at stake here and what we have to understand, and it's crucial, is that you can't have a democracy without informed citizens. You can't have a democracy without institutions that nurture critical thought. And what we're seeing now, more than ever, in many ways, it's not just a form of McCarthyism. We're seeing an attack on any institution that in some way does two things, provides the economic conditions for these institutions to function, in some way nurture their sense of critical inquiry. We're seeing that being eliminated. And we're seeing attacks on teachers. We're seeing attacks on educators who basically now are being fired if they somehow challenge the basic assumptions that drive a neoliberal, increasingly white Christian nationalist society.
Henry Giroux, please talk about your friendship with Pablo Freire, who he was, and why the two of you believed that democratizing education is the core of political resistance.
I mean, Paulo Freire was a Brazilian educator in a revolutionary of sorts. His seminal work was, of course, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is really a kind of guide to understanding education as a tool for liberation, particularly in the face of forms of education that promoted particular types of illiteracy, denied people their history, didn't give them the skills to be able to read and write and think critically, prevent them from in some way examining what the conditions were that suppressed them. And of course, he organized a literacy campaign in the 1960s in Brazil that was very empowering, and it gave people the opportunity to understand what it meant then to vote. In 1964, there was a military coup, and of course, Paulo was considered dangerous because, as one can say, like today, literacy is considered dangerous. The last thing that we want are people who basically can not only understand what democracy means, but basically can affirm its critical functions and enable it. Paulo and I became close friends in the 1980s, and we basically did everything we could to engage academics and young people and intellectuals in a way that would affirm the centrality of education to politics. We both believe that without a notion of critical education, you couldn't really take seriously what politics was about, because politics at its best, to say the very least, is about educating young people and others to understand the conditions under which they find themselves. And I think that in that sense, we had a books series for 15 years, publishing authors who basically could not get published in the mainstream press, and worked together to basically inform and expand the concept of critical pedagogy, which in many ways has now become an international movement that's even more important in light of the ongoing suppression of public and higher education all over the world.
Let's talk now a bit about how we can get a handle on all of this. You say, for example, that we need to start by addressing certain concrete problems that people face. So tell us, first of all, what you see as these concrete problems, and then how do we then address them?
I think it's very clear we need to address the question of poverty. We need to address the question of a decent wage. We need to address what it means to people who have access to adequate and meaningful health care, free health care. We need to talk about free education. We need to talk about the meaningful jobs. We need to talk about what it means in some way to be able to create the conditions for people to challenge the rise of white Christian nationalism, an enormously deep-seated anti-intellectualism, and the erosion of civil rights. I mean, there are two arguments here. One is, what are the economic conditions that people absolutely have to have in order to have a life in which they don't have to make a choice between getting medicine and basically eating food or providing food for their children? And that means you need a meaningful wage, you need free health care, you need funds allocated for child care, you need a decent wage, a meaningful minimum wage. You need to in some way figure out how make power more equal. You need to democratize institutions in ways that, it would seem to me, would give people the opportunity to have opportunities that would enhance their ability to have a decent and meaningful life. On the other side is the ideological issue. And the ideological issue is, what do we do to expand the concept of democracy as a public good? What do we do to fight for democracy in ways that suggest there has to be a certain sense of the social contract? There has to be something that brings people together and connects them rather than divides them. What do we need to do educationally to attack the rise of systemic racism? But I think that for me, as an educator, one of the things that I find most crippling ideologically in light of this conversation is the notion that all problems are individual problems.
We have no sense under neoliberalism of being able to translate private issues into larger systemic considerations. That's a massive form of depoliticization. It isolates problems, it blames people for the conditions under which they find themselves, and it normalizes enormous degrees of staggering inequality, the exploitation of the environment, a kind of rampant notion of self-interest, the demise of the social, the demise of the social state, and the rise of the punishing state. And so I think those two considerations have to be addressed. And these are very concrete issues, to say the least, because they bear down directly on how people live their lives, what their sense of individual and collective agency is, and how they understand themselves as being empowered to both address the conditions in which they find themselves and learn how to govern rather than be governed.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. Henry, George Orwell understood that whoever controls education has the power to shape the future. The right in this country understands this profoundly, don't they? And they've taken concrete steps to gain control of the U.S. educational system, haven't they?
The right has always understood, not always, but since the 1970s, they've understood that the question of ideas and who controls the apparatuses that produces and legitimates those ideas. I mean, C. Ray Mills talked about the cultural apparatuses and what an important role they play in basically providing the theoretical political worldviews to which people understand themselves and operate. And I think that when you think back to the Powell memo of the 1970s, in which Powell said, hey, look, the right has to be engaged in the struggle for ideas. It needs to create, for the most part, think tanks. It needs to, in some way, be associated with universities. It needs to control the media. And I think all of that has happened. I mean, you know, five major corporations control 90% of all the media that's consumed in the United States. And I think that in some ways, their attack on public education, not just simply control over the social media with Google and all that's an X and all that sort of thing, which is another form of education, but they now are going after schools in ways, in public and higher education, in ways that we have never seen before. So I think they take the question of ideas seriously, not as a form of enlightenment, but basically as a form of suppression. They want to basically eliminate the possibility for a culture of thoughtfulness, informed citizens, critical thinking, an expansion of the imagination. They don't want to have anything to do with any of that stuff.
Well, and Henry, I mean, civics isn't taught anymore, for example, in the public schools. We could talk about that. But I want to ask you this. Why do you believe that the right wing's wish to whitewash history? To what extent is that really a precursor to fascism, if you will?
Well, I think that it seems to me that history can be dangerous because it can be enlightening. It can essentially reveal a whole range of injustices that need to be addressed if a democracy is going to fulfill itself. And I think that it is a precursor to fascism because by erasing the complexities of history and focusing, for instance, on racial purity and nationalism, it opens the door to authoritarian rule. It isn't a matter of just learning from history. It's a matter of understanding how history is always alive in the present. And that whoever controls that history in some way controls what it means to legitimate certain narratives over others, i.e., for instance, to control certain collective identities. When you erase the memories of Palestinian history, when you erase the memories concerning slavery and Jim Crow, when you erase how horrible capitalism has been over the last 50 years and destroying just about everything it touches, it normalizes the worst forms of domination. It makes people believe that they're inferior. It makes people believe they have no history, that history basically is only written by the victors, by those who have power. History is probably the most important pedagogical tool we have because historical consciousness doesn't just inform the present, it shapes the present. And it says something about the possibilities of the future not being the present.
Please talk about what you call a long-standing right-wing strategy to transform public and higher education into either corporate adjuncts or white Christian indoctrination centers.
I mean, look, there's been a particular transformation around schooling in the last 50 years, particularly since the late 1970s and the late 1980s. I mean, at one point, the issue was whether schools educate people to be democratic citizens or just workers. And that was the battle that went on for a long time. And the right basically did everything it could to turn education, particularly public education, into simply, forms of training. I think that with 9/11 and the war on terror, the notion of education having a critical function came under attack in ways that we hadn't seen before. But I think what we see now is different. It's not just about suppressing education, critical forms of education. It's also about turning them into indoctrination centers, into centers to foster illiteracy, various forms of illiteracy, to foster white Christian nationalism, to foster a kind of highly extremist, corporatist mentality. It's a site that is now defined by three fundamentalisms: religious fundamentalism, economic fundamentalism, and political fundamentalism. So there's no attempt here in any way whatsoever to claim that education has to be defined through its claims on democracy, or that it should defend democracy, or that it should enable it. As a matter of fact, now the right defines education as something that has to be removed from democracy, and if anything, become a place where illiberal forms of democracy can be practiced. And it's in ways that we see in Hungary. You shape a curriculum to eliminate anything about trans people, you eliminate critical thought, you fire professors who are critical, and you shape the curriculum per se in the way that DeSantis wants to shape it, as simply a vehicle for the worst forms of propaganda.
And I wonder then, Henry, if you could please tell us as well, and especially our audience wants to hear this, I think, who was Primo Levi? And talk about his observation that every age has its own fascism, and that we see the warning signs wherever the concentration of power denies a country's citizens the possibility and the means of expressing.
What was so profound about him was that he didn't freeze the experience of Nazism in a particular historical moment. He said that every age has its own fascism, and it arises when power is concentrated to deny citizens their freedom. And he felt that with the erosion of democratic rights, the suppression of dissent, and the concentration of power in relatively few hands, what you end up with eventually are the camps. What you end up with is, at first, you suppress dissent, you suppress ideas, you kill the institutions that make them possible, you eliminate them, and then you kill the intellectuals and the poets and the cultural workers and the dissenters who make them possible. He saw a direct line between the suppression of dissent and basically the camp. And his argument was the elements of fascism take a different form in various societies, but the seeds are always there. And that you have to learn from history in order to recognize that.
Now, Henry Giroux, what does it mean to have a sense of hope in such dark times?
I think that, Michael, that's such a terrific question, because I think that without hope, there's no sense of agency. There's no sense of resistance. I think that when people can't imagine a future different from the present, there's no way to really understand that power is not just simply about domination, it's also about resistance. And that in every citadel and architecture of power, there are cracks, there are moments of resistance, there are possibilities. And without a sense of hope, you have no sense of agency. Without a sense of agency, you have no sense of hope. But I think that what we need to learn from this is that if you're going to have us, what the left and progressives need, they need to merge a sense of critique with a sense of possibility. And I want to make that concrete in that what I see happening today that around the question of criticism is that young people all over the globe are raising questions that basically expand and challenge issues that have become normalized for so long that they're now taken for granted. They no longer buy the assumption of common sense that capitalism is the only social order and social and economic order we can live in, that global capitalism can't be challenged, that justice doesn't matter, that protest is basically irrelevant in an age of mass suppression, that critical dissent doesn't have a place in a society that claims that there's no room for it. And I think that they're not only raising questions that basically have not been raised in the past or in the last 15 to 20 years, they're also working internationally with others across borders to basically try to understand how they can become a global force rather than just simply a national and limited social movement. Secondly, it seems to me that many of these social movements that operate off specific forms of oppression, whether we're talking about gender, the exploitation of women, the suppression of women's rights, or we're talking about the attack on civil rights around certainly black civil rights, or we're talking about poverty and those groups that are working to eliminate it and in some way address staggering forms of inequality, or climate activists, all of these groups increasingly realize they can't do this alone. They really have to connect with each other because these problems are connected. You can't talk about democracy and claim you're against the destruction of the planet around climate issues and be a racist. Democracy has a large expanse, a large umbrella. And it seems to me when we talk about political, economic, and social rights as being absolutely central to what it means to live in a radical democracy or a democratic socialist society, these movements have to come together and fight for that. And then at the same time, of course, do everything they can to make us understand the particular forms of oppression that they talk about.
Last year on the college campuses, we saw an amazing uprising of protest against what Israel with the armaments of the U.S. is doing in Gaza. We saw, as you pointed out earlier in this show, though, a draconian crackdown on that right to dissent by the administrators of these colleges. Since that time, the rules restricting protests on college campuses has grown even and more severe and more strict. Are you nevertheless hopeful, given what we've seen the students do around this issue, that come this, and we are now back to school, that we'll begin to see those kinds of protests again, not only on the college campuses, but throughout our society?
No, I am hopeful. I think that what has happened is that the protests have moved now to a somewhat different level. Now it's clear that the militarization of the university, it's turned to forms of academic suppression and the violation of free speech and the firing of faculty, has really reached a new level of intensity and is being expanded. And I think that what these groups are now doing is they're mobilizing in ways to sort of link those issues so that they're not just talking about the struggle over Palestinian sovereignty, which is paramount. They're also talking about how these institutions are now under the control of billionaires and a form of gangster capitalism that has to be addressed, that these issues can't be separated. And I think what young people are doing now are mobilizing both, not only on the campus in the most spectacular ways, but mobilizing off the campuses and trying to join with labor unions and others to begin to produce a movement that will have very concrete effects. You know, the old saying by Mario Savio in the 1960s is you've got to stop the machine. The dock workers stopped the machine. And I think that young people are starting to learn from that. The auto workers stopped the machine. And I think that what we need is a mass collective movement in which we're in the streets and we stop these institutions from working. They've got to be stopped. They just can't go on being controlled by a ruling elite that is heartless and cruel. The Elon Musk of the world, I mean, they're part of a larger financial class. And what that's called is neoliberal capitalism on steroids. And when it begins to fail and it can't legitimate its own arguments, it turns to force. It turns to fascism. And that's what we're seeing now.
Henry Giroux, Jim Laffer and I are extremely grateful for your articulation of the situation that we're in. We totally support your viewpoint. We're very, very happy to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you so much. Thank you. How can people get in touch with you and follow your work?
I have a website, first of all, at Henry A. Giroux, just one word, .com. And also people can get in touch with me by Gmail, henry.giroux@gmail.com. And also I'm on Twitter.
That's Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. Thanks, Henry. You take it easy. We'd love to have you back. Been great to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Forces of the gathering authoritarian storm in our country are evident in many ways. It is manifesting itself in powerful and continuing nationalism, in disdain for human rights, in the entwinement of government and religion, in a controlled mass media, in the protection of corporate power and the suppression of labor power, and in the encouragement of violence. The power of labor has been channeled into the Democratic and Republican parties, the twin parties of capitalism. We need a workers' party, but we don't even have the nucleus of one. Race and gender are formative in the building of authoritarian regimes. We see this in the USA. Haitians who are black have been accused of eating cats and dogs. Women's rights to control their own bodies is under attack from the Supreme Court on down, and women are marked as childless cat ladies and told to stay home and bear children. We speak today with Diane Feeley on race and gender as formative in building authoritarian regimes and the potential power of our labor movement long buried in the clutches of the Democratic and Republican parties. Diane Feeley is an editor of the magazine Against the Current. She's a leader of Solidarity, a socialist feminist organization. Diane lives in Detroit, where she's been an activist for many years in the United Automobile Workers Union. Diane Feeley, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Diane, Chris Hedges, our previous guest, who inaugurated our series on fascism, what it is and how to fight it, is of the opinion that labor has to be central to protecting ourselves and to fight back. Why is this so?
Well, I agree with Chris on this. First of all, the membership of a union is diverse. And since we live in a highly segregated society in terms of where we live, the kinds of schools we go to, it's really the most diverse place we will be in. And we're there for quite a while every week. Not only is it a diverse place where people of all opinions, of various races and ethnicities and genders all work. And what is our job? What is the idea of a union? A union is not an insurance company. It's a membership organization. And therefore, it's about what we want in terms of our wages, our working conditions, our benefits. So we're concerned about the quality of our life, the security of our life, not only at our workplace, but also in our communities. So it's a very social place to be. And it's also a very democratic or potentially democratic place, where we have to listen to each other, where we get to debate and discuss and decide what our priorities are. So all of this really teaches us solidarity, not only with who are our co-workers, but other people, because we can't just be concerned about our own selves. We live in this larger world. So that sense of solidarity, that sense that we are all human, operates against the idea of fascism, where only some are humans and others are subhumans. So it's really a very important institution in our society to really develop ourselves as human beings. So the potential of democracy through the unions, of course, can have a big impact not only on our jobs and our communities, but in a broader sense in our world and how we organize ourselves.
Diane, historically, the trade union movement in the United States has taken the pragmatic position of rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. Sometimes they've supported the Democrats, therefore, and sometimes the Republicans. But what has been the result, do you think, of this pragmatism? I mean, after all, the wages of workers in America have not gone up in real terms for, 50 years? And now we see a growing fascist movement, which is enjoying historic support among many sections of the working class. So how do you assess the consequences of this traditional union pragmatism?
I think it shows how so much of what we've learned in school and in our society and even in some unions is actually wrong and not helpful to us. We are taught that, I remember in grammar school learning that if you didn't like the situation in your country, you voted out the party that was in power for the other party. That is, it was a two-party system. And also a great focus on the individual candidate rather than on the structure. What's the structure of our society and how can we make that structure